appeared to me he was fighting for his life, but suffocating. The agony and terror of watching my dad suffocate to death lasted more than 19 minutes. It was the most awful moment in my life to witness my dad's execution. I can't think of any other way to describe it than torture.
That's Dennis McGuire, son of Dennis McGuire, executed by the state of Ohio in 2014. Megan, we have 30 seconds. Is this set in stone that these men will be executed in Arkansas? I mean, this country has never seen anything like this.
That's right. I mean, that is certainly the plan that Arkansas has for moving forward. But it's not an appropriate plan. This drug is not effective and appropriate for this use. And there's no reason to rush to carry out these executions by the end of April when other drugs are available. And even this drug continues to be available to other states. And so it's really a manufactured situation that can be avoided.
Megan McCracken, we want to thank you for being with us, attorney with the Death Penalty Clinic at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. And that does it for our broadcast. Check our job listings at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Ndura, Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Paul Huckabee, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prud, Ariel Boone. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The KABU Community Radio Artists in Residence Program application period is open. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KABU mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The Artists in Residence Program is open to artists of all disciplines whose project proposals include sound as a major component. Applications for the KABU 2017 Artists in Residence are due Friday, April 7th. More information can be found at kabu.fm/kabuair2017.
Ballot Measure 57, Oregon's mandatory minimum sentencing law for nonviolent property crimes, accounts for nearly half the women serving prison time in Oregon. And as Oregon legislators consider opening a second women's prison, a new report, Unlocking Measure 57, explains how the development of Oregon criminal laws over the last few decades has widened the net of defendants receiving mandatory minimum sentences for property offenses. The report calls on Oregon lawmakers to repeal Measure 57. Hear the report on Prison Pipeline, March 20th at 6:30 p.m.
This is KBOO Portland.
Talk about destruction. Don't you know what you can count me? In, out, in, out. Be all right. Be all right. Be all right. See, you got a resolution. Well, you know. Well, I'd love to see the flag. You ask for a contribution. Well, you know. Well, doing what we can. One money people mind that hate. I'll tell you, brother, have to wait. Constitution, well, you know, they don't want to change your head. And act as an institution, well, you know, better free your mind instead. Go kind of picture chairman Mao, gonna make it anyhow. Be alright, be alright, be alright. Be alright. All right.
And good morning. Here we are once again. Another Wednesday has rolled around. My name's Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. Be here till 9 o'clock. We got an hour full of conversation and call-ins. I'm going to be talking with Theo Anderson, the author of The Right-Wing Machine, Behind the Curtain. The scariest thing about the Trump administration isn't Trump. Well, I'm not sure I totally agree with that, but we'll have that conversation coming up in just a second. I want to let you know that the quagmire continues. 14 years in Iraq is going to be an event this Friday, March 17th at 5 p.m. Pioneer Courthouse Square, sponsored by the Peace and Justice Works Iraq Affinity Group and others. Another anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq on March 19th, 2003. And if anybody wants to have their event announced on Wednesday Talk Radio, can't speak for the other shows, you can write me at paulrkboo@gmail.com. Or you can, like the person who put this in my box. We have a bunch of boxes in the lobby here at KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th. You can put an event notice in my box or anything else you want in my box. Well, you know, nothing that's going to hurt anyone. But, or you can, you can friend me on Facebook. I don't have a Facebook page for this show, but I do have a personal one, Paul Alkire Rowland. That's my middle name. Anyway, here we are, and we're going to talk about more about Trumpism and what's behind it with, again, our guest, Theo Anderson, who is a staff writer for In These Times. He's got his PhD in modern U.S. history from Yale University, and he's working on a book about the intellectual and religious origins of conservatism and progressivism. I got all that from his blurb at the In These Times website, where now I just noticed just today his article is up. It, of course, comes out in print first, and then a little later it goes up on the website. So good morning, Theo.
Good morning. Good to be here.
And everybody's talking about Trump, everybody trying to make sense of what's going on. And of course, in your piece, you talk about it being a long time in the making. Of course, not just the scenario you put out, which centers around the Heritage Foundation and ALEC and other what I consider sort of reactions to the 1960s. Mm-hmm. But also Trump is a long time making. Yeah, so kind of lay out your basic argument to start us off.
All right. Well, let me give a little context that I wasn't able to go into in the piece because of space considerations. But as you say, this is very much a reaction to some of the turbulence of the 1960s. In the early 1970s, there's a push by conservative interest groups. It's summed up, probably a lot of your listeners will have heard of the Powell Memo. 1971. He's a corporate attorney and writes a memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce complaining that business interests and the free enterprise system are really under attack in the United States, and says we need to get together, we need to coordinate on an agenda for reasserting the values of the free enterprise system. I should say that the Nixon administration, it was very conservative in one sense, very law and order, but also it was still very much living in the aftermath of the Great Society of the Johnson administration, and did what we would consider some progressive things, like the founding of the Environmental Protection Agency in 1970. Nixon also proposed a universal health care plan. That's largely forgotten, but we very nearly had a very different healthcare system in the United States. Democrats killed it because they didn't think it went far enough. There's Powell and business interests are very concerned about the a diminution of the free enterprise system. And in 1973, Joseph Coors, the beer magnate from Colorado, invests in founding the Heritage Foundation along with the American Legislative Exchange Council. And kind of the genius behind both of those organizations is Paul Weyrich. He's a right-wing activist who's very influential all the way through his death in 2006 in right-wing causes. There are several other conservative institutions. Sort of the infrastructure of the conservative movement is built during the 1970s. Not only Heritage and ALEC, but the Manhattan Institute, the Cato Institute, Citizens for Sound Economy, those kinds of institutions, the sort of the intellectual framework of conservatism are built in the 1970s, Heritage being part of it. Weyrich left Heritage after a couple of years to found a different organization that was devoted to promoting, conservatives within politics, the electoral politics realm. But Heritage moves on to become really influential in the Reagan administration. It proposes very specific policies for how the budget could be cut during in 1981, right after Reagan was elected. And it has a 2,000 or actually 3,000 page manifesto with detailed policy recommendations. Reagan distributes this to his cabinet. He's really taken with it. It has some effect in the first year. There are cuts to the Department of Education initially. Most of that agenda gets lost through the course of Reagan's administration, primarily because Democrats are still very influential in Congress. His agenda doesn't really work out like he had planned, but he does get tax cuts through. He gets that element of his agenda. So that's in the 1980s. Heritage, moves on and goes on to become even more powerful. But there's a real sort of the pivot of my story is 2010, the opposition to Obamacare and the Tea Party movement that emerges around 2009 and 2010. And the Heritage Foundation sort of becomes the foundation of that, sort of the intellectual foundation of that, becomes very much a cheerleader for it and is tightly linked to the Tea Party movement. The president of the foundation, Jim DeMint, he's a former senator from South Carolina. He takes a tour of the country and sort of taunts Congress people who aren't on board with shutting down the government in 2013. And really, antagonizes them. And Heritage was in danger of sort of sabotaging itself because that very activist turn, sort of hard right activist turn, alienated some of the more moderate Republicans. But it really has paid off with the election of Trump because, Trump's agenda is basically drawn directly from Heritage's agenda, as it did with the Reagan administration in 1981. It created last year what it calls the Blueprint for Reform. It's about a 200-page document that goes through and specifically recommends cuts to the federal budget. And one of the people who led a Heritage Policy Institute is one of the key economic advisors for the Trump administration. So basically very influential in writing the first budget, which essentially proposes to gut the Environmental Protection Agency. There's some interesting symmetry there since, Heritage was basically founded not directly in opposition to the EPA, but sort of that whole wave in the early 1970s that was trying to oppose overregulation, the regulatory state. Anyway, the Trump agenda, the Trump budget that we expect any day now, basically is drawn from the Heritage Foundation blueprint for balance, it's called. So, and also the Heritage staff has been deeply influential in the transition. Several dozen staff members from Heritage staffed the transition team and have been active in the early weeks of the administration. So there's a lot of cross-fertilization there. You know, it's hard to discern what Trump is all about. He's talked talked on so many different sides of every issue. Seems to not to have much of an ideological core. But sort of my argument in the piece is that has served the purposes of the hard right conservative movement and Heritage in particular very well. It sort of made him their tool to carry out this agenda that they've been pursuing for the last 40 some years.
It's kind of like this moment is sort of like their wet dream from their very beginnings in a sense.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, if you don't have reason to study this, it's sort of hard to put the pieces together, but from a big picture view, it all kind of makes sense. Like this Powell memo in the early 70s, and then the founding of all these institutions, and then Reagan's election was really critical, not because he got his budget got his wishes necessarily, but he sort of set the gave the movement its rhetoric and its. It's guiding light, so to speak. And so 2010 was a key election because, the Republicans basically took control of the state houses. That's an interesting story in itself. The Republican dominance at the state level, and now they're threatening to do the same thing at the federal level. So I guess in a perverse sense, it's a hopeful story in that one movement that's really determined and has a guiding vision can dramatically transform the landscape, the political and economic landscape of the nation in basically two generations.
Unfortunately, my cynical response is we no longer have the two generation long game anymore, given what's happening to our global ecosystems. But let's leave that aside. I just wanted to let people know that I believe you're going to have to leave a little early. So all those callers who wait for the last 15 minutes, you really should start calling now. And the number is 503-231-8187. Again, I'm speaking with Theo Anderson, who wrote this month's cover article for In These Times, a good old left publication that's been kind of one of the longer running monthly magazines at this point. In These Times,
we've had our 40th anniversary.
40th anniversary, yeah. Around the same time as the people you're writing about.
Exactly.
And so the article is The Right Wing Machine Behind the Curtain, The Scariest Thing About the Trump Administration Isn't Trump, talking about these institutions that were formed, again, as a reactionary retrenchment, as I put it on my program page, to the threat of the 1960s, which we shouldn't underestimate the extent to which that period shook up the ruling elites and, again, led to... what's the institutions that basically, as you put in your article, set the stage for what's happening now. Again, 503-231-8187. I just want to throw out this one thing. So, I mean, the question is, of course, which I guess you could ask of the capitalist system in general, is who's using who? I mean, it does seem like if you the deeper you get and there's so many roadblocks laid in the way of to actually understanding what may have set the stage for Trump's decision to run for president. I'm sure there's many intersecting factors, but apparently some of them might be his own indebtedness. He has his own economic reasons. So, you know, who's using who in this scenario?
Well, what's really remarkable, if you go through the budget blueprint that Heritage put out and what we've heard so far, what the Trump budget looks like, is how really vicious they are toward any kind of environmental regulations or green economy initiatives. I think that Trump, as far as I can tell, doesn't care much about any kind of ideology, but he's willing to use whoever has the money and will allow him to hold power. So I think what I'm saying is, like, honestly, if it comes down right down to it, I think evangelical Christians are using Trump as much as anything. That's another part of the story I didn't really get into, but
well, the organization that Weyrich founded, wasn't that the Moral Majority? After he left Heritage,
yeah, in late 79 and in 80. So these business interests are hostile to the regulatory state, but at the same time, evangelical Christians are really angry about what they see as interference in their private institutions in the 70s, and this is specifically about integration and Bob Jones University, the school in South Carolina, doesn't want to have to admit African American students, and doesn't until 1975, and loses its IRS tax exempt status. So that's kind of the flashpoint for evangelical Christians and there were other incidents, but that's the most notable one. But for them to become really engaged. And that's like the early form of the religious liberty crusade. I mean, you'll hear that now in reference to LGBTQ issues and, you know, the push for Christians not to have to serve, Christian bakers and florists not to have to serve at same-sex weddings and things like that. So it's this idea of freedom sort of unites business conservatives and evangelical Christians, but evangelical Christians are the ones who really have the boots on the ground that provide the grassroots energy. So if I'm going to have to say, you know, who's using who, I think it's very much evangelicals have used Trump and Reagan before that to carry out their agenda. And, you know, in a way, I guess business interests have used evangelicals. So a lot of people using each other for their own purposes, but it's all united under this banner of reclaiming their so-called freedom.
Mm-hmm. And again, the number is 503-231-8187. We encourage you to get your calls in early because our guest, Theo Anderson, is going to have to cut out a few minutes early. He's got a meeting to go to at noon. So talk a little more about the, you know, I it's just so easy to miss things if you're not really focused, like in researching and writing. So this figure, Paul Weyrich, I certainly heard of him, but his centrality, his crucial importance has kind of eluded me and possibly some other people listening. Talk a little bit more about, like, his origins, you know, what formed his ideology.
Yeah, he's an interesting person. He's I can't remember the author, but some people have called him one of the four architects of the modern conservative movement, along with Buckley, Goldwater, and Ronald Reagan. But yeah, he's not that well known. He's mostly been forgotten, except among, you know, people who study this. But he was a press aide to a senator from Colorado in the late 1960s. He and the guy who eventually founded Heritage with him, Ed Fulner, took kind of a first crack at starting a policy institute in 1971. That didn't really go anywhere. But then, like I said, he got Joseph Coors to put up money for the Heritage Foundation in 1973, and things took off from there. But he was a very conservative Catholic, very, very interested in sort of grassroots democracy as he understood it. He was one of the first people to really see the potential of evangelical Christians and working through churches to mobilize them. That's why he, you know, got connected with Jerry Falwell and they founded the Moral Majority, which pretty much helped Reagan win. I mean, it's contested whether they were the decisive factor, but they were certainly important to his victory. So he's a complicated figure. I mean, you know, some people would say he believed in theocracy, that basically, you know, the Bible should be our law and we should be governed by a religious law. He always denied that, but his politics were very far to the right. I guess the complicating factor is he really did believe in working through, you know, the democratic system to achieve his goals. He's very much like Steve Bannon. If you listen to his rhetoric, he's sort of famous for saying he didn't believe everybody should vote because that gave Christians more leverage when people didn't vote. He said that in 1980 at a conference of evangelical Christians. But he's basically a genius at organizing. Founded several organizations that are still around and still important.
So do you think he was an influence on Steve Bannon?
Not really. I think they're both very conservative Catholic. They sort of hold the same worldview, but I don't know that they, you know, that there's a direct influence. Where there is a direct influence is on Mike Pence. He was a mentor to Mike Pence. He once said that Pence is about as good as it gets in terms of politicians. When Pence was first thinking about running for Congress in 1988, he came to Washington, D.C., and had a meeting with Weyrich, sought his help, and he got his help. He lost that race. But you know, he was definitely an influence on Pence. And as I say in the piece, Mike Pence is basically a poster child for this heritage agenda and the ALEC agenda of cutting taxes, cutting services, basically, you know, gutting any kind of social services and creating what they would call a business-friendly environment that's basically just rock-bottom wages and no regulation is what it amounts to.
Yeah, you say here, Weyrich spoke a language of personal responsibility that resonated with evangelicals. He believed that individualism was the heart of the Judeo-Christian tradition, and his great nemesis was the growth of government. Quote, in all of the teachings of the New Testament, you never heard Jesus Christ say that it's the responsibility of society or it's the responsibility of government to take care of this, he told the PBS show Frontline in 1966. Quote, he always said, it's your responsibility. When he talked to the rich man, he told the rich man it was his responsibility to divest himself of some of his riches to help the poor and so on. It was never a case of asking the government to intervene. That seems to be a really kind of crucial bedrock part of his ideology and generally the evangelical sort of individualistic free enterprise ideology.
Yeah, that talk of the Judeo-Christian tradition is also very Bannon-esque. I mean, I think Bannon might be even a little more extreme than Weyrich in talking about the notion of the Judeo-Christian tradition being under assault. And, you know, and Bannon's talked about being a Leninist because he wants to create a revolution. Weyrich said the same kind of thing about how, you know, we're not the old style conservatives. We're basically out to overturn the existing political order. You know, it'd be interesting to know if there are direct influences from Weyrich to Bannon because they do talk some similar language. But I think, you know, there doesn't really need to be the direct influence because it's just kind of in the air in that sector of the right, that kind of revolutionary talk, and you know, the talk of radically overthrowing the regulatory state, things like that.
Well, you know, I don't know if we've stunned people into paralysis here, but we would like to get some people to join our conversation. You're only going to have probably another 15, 20 minutes. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm speaking with Theo Anderson, the author of The Right-Wing Machine Behind the Curtain, new piece, front page story for the In These Times magazine. Go ahead with your thought there. Sorry.
I was just going to say that this whole question of individualism, individualism and freedom is so interesting with the talk about repealing Obamacare and Paul Ryan saying, you know, people are free now. We've liberated them from having to buy insurance and from that mandate without any kind of acknowledgement that maybe people won't buy insurance because they don't have the money. Like, the notion of freedom is just so twisted. But it's also very powerful, like, because it taps into, you know, an American tradition of you know, throwing off our British oppressors from the very beginning. So it's a language that resonates, but it's also a very twisted understanding of freedom.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a very complex subject. The whole, you know, we'd have to do a whole theological analysis here, which is actually worth doing. I don't think we, you know, on the general so-called left, I don't think we take seriously enough, except for, you know, maybe people like, I guess, Jim Wallace, some of the other, you know, progressive evangelicals, of whom there are some, who really, you know, try to engage with on their level the this sort of strain. It's a, you know, the idea of, like, Jesus Christ being a capitalist is a strange sort of revisionist view of history. It sort of is basically a complete you know, basically projecting onto their times the ideology that people hold today. But the idea of they completely leave out of, sure, Jesus did want to overturn. I mean, this gets into so complicated because, you know, I'm personally against, if you get down to it, in a sense, the federal government, but in a very radically different way. I believe in mutual aid and people helping each other in a direct sense. And I believe that, you know, the whole process of the colonization of the United States, the imposition of this European rule, has been very devastating to this continent and the peoples that lived here, and not to mention the African slaves who were brought along to build up the whole enterprise, and who were just sort of ruthlessly used and then cast aside, and now continually marginalized and imprisoned and brutalized by the system. And of course, I think it's largely a white guilt, a sort of denial of reality, that leads to the kind of phenomenon that we're talking about. It's a retrenchment of sort of this, a reimposition of sort of a mythical social reality, you know, whether they, you know, people say we want to go back to the 1950s or whatever period that they're trying to go back to, some sort of better days before the terrible 60s. But anyway, leaving all that aside, I certainly believe that, you know, whatever there is that's helpful in the welfare state should be maintained until we can come up with something better. And I don't believe that these people really are truly Christian in the sense that I understand Christianity, which is, again, you know, helping your fellow human being and treating them like loving your neighbor as yourself. Anyway, I just had to say that. I know you're writing a book about all this. I'd be interested in sort of your take.
Well, you know, there's a long tradition of claiming Jesus for your side. You know, in the 1920s, there's a best-selling book called, I'm blanking on the name of it right now, but it's Bruce Barton's book, and he's basically claiming that Jesus was the greatest businessman, you know, because he organized his disciples and created this hugely successful organization and operation. So, you know, the attempt to claim Jesus for right-wing causes or for business-friendly causes is very old. And then, you know, in the 60s, you have sort of the reverse of that, the liberation theology and the push to recast Jesus as more of a you know, a great moral teacher, and Christianity as a form of social, early Christianity as a form of socialism. So, you know, I don't know what to do with that. You know, you can, the uses of Jesus are endless, but I do know that, you know, what we've seen over the last 40, 45 years of this conservative movement has been dramatically energized by a certain vision of Jesus as the exemplar of individualism, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but it does resonate with many people. So, you know, I guess the only hope I hold out, as I say in the piece, is, you know, that this movement shows that it can be done, that you can put forth a vision and change the nation. I know, you know, when I said that earlier, you said we don't have two generations, and that may be the case, but you know, look, if we're looking for silver linings, I think people organized, mobilized, like hopefully we're seeing right now in the wake of Trump's election, can really change things.
And again, a key point there, though, also, and not to discourage people, because, you know, certainly Fidel Castro and his small band was also a great example of how the element of surprise and strong, dedicated commitment can overturn great odds. But the reality is that the very business interests that are claiming Jesus for their own are able to mobilize their vast resources, and that's sort of what created this machine. You know, the Koch brothers, the Coors, all these huge fortunes have basically used the framework that exists, the constitutional framework, and sort of manipulated it to basically go in their favor through various machinations. But I we do have a couple callers finally at 503-231-8187. So let's go to Colin. Go ahead, you're on the air.
So good morning, you guys. It's nice to hear this conversation. I have a conversation with a lot of people I know that's very similar to this, you know, where the church and state, you know, and how, you know, the danger of those two things being, you know, melded back together, and our forefathers seeing that danger, and, you know, why it's so important to pay attention to that. But I just want you guys' thoughts on this. So, I mean, I'm kind of watching a worldwide event, more of a Western philosophical way of the blowback of the last 8 years of our administration, you know, in a grassroots movement, putting someone in that position. Not that I always agreed with the, you know, Barack's policies, but to see that they're like recreating, just even in a worldwide phenomenon, this very right-wing us and them agenda, in which, you know, you have to have a separation of the types of people and the types of religions and types of viewpoints so you can guide, you know, your message and, you know, to the masses about, not really so much because it's a moral, you know, obligation, but more because, you know, in the Western world and how, you know, our dominance, you know, the dominionist kind of view of having the world and controlling it and using God as their vessel to say, this is why we have the right to do this. But the reason I'm bringing that up is it seems to be this is happening all over the place right now. It's not really just happening here. It's more like they need to regain that mythology that, you know, there is an us and there is a them, and whose team are you on? And I'll leave you guys with that.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of comfort in that paradigm, although, you know, as destructive as it is and as misguided as it is from my perspective, it also gives a certain sense of order to the world. And maybe some of the, you know, turbulence we're experiencing from globalism, maybe some of that is feeding, I would think that's feeding some of this, you know, resorting to just sort of giving it up to God and putting our faith in corporations and you know, the Christian God and the right wing definition of Christianity. I certainly think that's a factor, and in what's going on here, and it's manifesting in various ways, you know, globally. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I actually, since we don't have a whole lot of time, we do have one more caller. Let's just go to our next caller, which is Don. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. I just I wondered if you have any hope in the idea that we can remove the status of personhood from corporations anytime in the near future. I think that's a very basic corrupting influence on the whole democratic process.
Well, your guess is as good as ours, I would say. That's my flippant response, you know. I mean, sure, that's one of the key pillars of whatever it will take to turn back this disastrous tide that's happening. Certainly, that's it. I mean, but it's enshrined into the, you know, into the Constitution itself, really, through the Commerce Clause. I mean, sort of set the stage for that. We can't deny that. So, I mean, this stuff's really deep. But I don't know. What do you think, Theo?
I mean, I think that's the result of Supreme Court decisions, though. It's not, that's an interpretation of the Constitution. I don't think it has to be that way. But I don't see anything on the horizon that suggests that we're about to reverse the personhood of corporations. I mean, we're in a moment where they're pretty much having their way at the state and federal level, and, you know, to some extent at the local level. So I think it's a great ideal. It's something to strive for, but the landscape for that happening in the near future, no, I don't think so. I wanted to I was going to mention something that I forgot about evangelicals. We so closely associate them right now with Republicans and conservatism, but, you know, in 1976 they were key to Jimmy Carter's coalition, and really turned on him pretty quickly in his administration. But that's also, you know, just to say that it doesn't have to be this way. The way it looks right now, it doesn't have to be that way. It had to do a lot with race relations, it's not like evangelicals are just a lost cause for Democrats if they're interested. I mean, they have been for the last 30 years, but, you know, things change is what I'm saying.
Well, you know, that it just so gets into these deep fears that go, and the manipulation of those fears that go, you know, so far back. I mean, the twin fears of, you know, the Native American and of the African are just so buried so deep in our psyche and are so manipulated in so many subtle and unconscious ways, and so many direct and conscious ways as well, you know, whether it's, you know, the post Civil War period, whether it's the post civil rights period, the manipulation of the, you know, the poor white voter, or, you know, the Southern voter, the Southern white voter, the people who, you know, could find common cause even through their religion if they were to look there, instead find that manipulated by these larger powers into being pitted against the people who they could find. Certainly you would think they could find common cause against a figure like Donald Trump, for crying out loud.
You would think.
You
yeah
would think.
It's remarkable. The, you know, the commonly cited number is that 81% of evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. So, you know, it's just, it is amazing, given his record and his statements over the years and his behavior. But I think what you're saying is right. Like, it's for evangelicals a very, very much a question of identity and the sense of a lost identity, losing the culture, losing what they knew, and that, you know, that can be manipulated pretty easily by a guy like Trump. my basically a charlatan who has charisma, you know. But when people feel like they're losing their sense of identity and losing their country, then someone who like Trump who speaks to that, you know, that they can be moved. Unfortunately.
Well, let's get another caller in, Don. Or no, I'm sorry. Who's our next call? Connor, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to hear your comments about, you know, we talk about the rise of these right-wing foundations and their ability to organize and stay pertinent, stay relevant over time. And I find it fascinating that despite, you know, I think on the right wing, just as on the left wing, there's all kinds of factions. There's a spectrum of ideologies within that, you know, wing, as you might call it. And how this, I find it fascinating how they're able to get over their differences and organize and persist with their ideology despite their differences. And they somehow manage to, again, line up behind this banner. And why does that not happen on the left? Why? That's my question. I realize it's a complex question, but what is it about the other side of the political spectrum that really seems to, I don't know, inhibit people or hinder people's ability to organize, get over their minor philosophical differences? You know, I think, again, people exist on the left side of the sphere, and they have pet causes here and there, but those are used as wedges and keep people apart. And so is the only hope in terms of organizing a counterforce to these very powerful right-wing forces, you know, relying on some, you know, radical left-wing billionaire who will leave us their fortune? What are the options? You know, what can people do? You know, and again, I'll leave it at this with one more thought. You know, Bernie Sanders, again, I'm not going to talk about that too much. He obviously managed to get people to donate, a maximum of $27. So, again, I'm interested to hear your thoughts, your ideas about some options. So I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Well, When you answer something like that, you very quickly get into broad generalizations. But
and of course, let me just say, we're you know, people like you who write these kind of articles, and me who's a talk show host, we're sort of called upon to be sort of generalized experts on all these political, which of course I wouldn't claim to be. But anyway, that caveat said, go ahead.
Well, one thing about the Tea Party movement, I'll say, and you know, conservatism generally, and the reason that they're able to hang together and be more organized, I think that has partly to do with demographics. The Tea Party skewed older and whiter. Those are the people who almost always vote, feel like their, you know, economic interests are very much at stake and have resources and get out and vote and So there's a demographic advantage for the GOP, and there are all kinds of, you know, related efforts on the part of the GOP to suppress the vote, not only get their vote out, but suppress the vote on the other side. and that's been pretty well documented over the last few years. On the progressive side, and why, there's more difficulty in organizing and staying together is partly, I think, and I would be interested in your thoughts on that, if conservatives have the rallying cry of freedom and protecting our freedom, what's the equivalent for progressives? I mean, it's human rights, it's equality, but I don't think that those galvanize people the same way that, you know, that the right wing telling people that their freedom is under assault does. I just think that there's not the same kind of mantra, the same kind of rallying theme that would organize people, at least not yet.
Well, that's true. Well, the point I made earlier is that we're all already been divided along, gender, race, other lines. Like, you know, certainly the civil rights movement galvanized African Americans, and then of course right away some of the, you know, what are termed minor philosophical differences came out between generationally, radicals and reformists, all these things that are, you know, across all movements, those same fraction lines always appear. And then certainly, you know, the American Indian movement galvanized the indigenous people of the United States as the Standing Rock movement did. Mm-hmm. But of course, those movements threaten, as you said, the identity of this, you know, the settler, colonial, white, male patriarchal, you know, whatever you want to call it. Of course, that, you know, it cuts so many different ways. But so, yeah, I mean, that's the task has been to, you know, unite, you know, I think, you know, maybe Fred Hampton had, to me, one of the most brilliant and powerful examples of a real challenge was the original Rainbow Coalition. And of course, what happened to him? You know, I mean, that's also the reality, is when people like figures or movements do rise up that do have that that multi-ethnic, hopefully multi-gender, multi-whatever, you know, the dream that some of us have of something truly new and different is, you know, they tend to be heavily repressed. And so that's also the nature, because we do live within a, you know, even though we have attempts to, you know, and sometimes successfully to make the federal system more responsive to more types of people who have been left out, we also have what's called the deep state, the ideological hard pan, which remains through the generations, and now, unfortunately, they seem to have it all, you know, and someone like Steve Bannon, sort of like their, sort of as a puppeteer, you know, along, you know, well, he's sort of being used also by the more powerful, wealthy elements, but they're all of a piece. Anyway, I said a little bit too much. I know you said you had to go. I don't know. Can you stick around till the end of the hour at this point, or?
5 more minutes.
Okay, 5 more minutes. Thank you so much. I know you originally said you had to leave at a quarter of. We really appreciate your sticking around. Again, if anybody has one quick last call, 503-231-8187. Getting into some difficult stuff. Again, I'm talking with Theo Anderson, the author of The Right Wing Machine, Behind the Curtain. The scariest thing about the Trump administration isn't Trump, or I would say isn't only Trump, that's for sure. Cover story for In These Times. This has been a really interesting conversation. I just want to say one thing. This is probably not the most important thing, but this wonderful cover by, I don't know who's the artist who did this?
You know, I don't know. I'll find out and email you.
Oh, that's too bad. I was hoping to be able to give kudos where kudos are due. You know, it's because a lot of people get these things and don't see. But anyway, it's the figure of Trump as Oz, this very beautiful thing. But again, you know, Oz, of course, turned out to be this kindly old man who's, you know, for whatever reasons was, and of course, that's sort of the Hollywood, you know, dream that we're probably all sort of enthralled to. Oh, it's all going to turn out okay. You know, let's just give Trump a chance. But that's unfortunately not going to be the case in this point.
Yeah. The cover was terrific. You're right. I'm sorry. I don't know who did it. I wanted to get in one thing about, I don't think I said enough about the state level attack. So I mentioned that 1973 Heritage and ALEC were both co-founded by Paul Weyrich. I'm imagining your listeners have heard of ALEC, but you know, its story has just been remarkable over the last few years. And you know, it proposes these model bills in states, typically to restrict, basically to get unions through the right to work legislation. And other measures. I think now about 25 states have right to work legislation that's hollowing out unions. I would frame it as ALEC as being like the state level operator that's doing what Heritage is trying to do at the federal level. So kind of coming at it from both angles, state level and federal level. And you know, in 2008, when Barack Obama
was elected, it seemed like a progressive moment. It seemed like a progressive ascendancy, at least for some people. You know, and but so what was going on sort of under the radar, and we're just learning this now, is that ALEC and Heritage are both, you know, emerging as the real power players in American politics. I guess my point is, you just never know how these things are going to turn out. Often, the most important currents are going on kind of under the surface and don't emerge for several years, and then it seems obvious in retrospect. And I guess I'm taking a stab at saying something hopeful, which is that, you know, I think we're seeing some progressive momentum right now that might not have an immediate payoff, but could also work to overturn some of the terrible effects of what we've seen from the conservative movement from the last 40 years. Who knows? But it's really interesting how, you know, the things that were going on under the surface are just now becoming clear.
Well, it's interesting. You know, you say the fight against Obamacare sort of re-galvanized the Heritage, and now you see that being sort of the centerpiece of the current struggles, and sort of, you know, who knows where that's going to go. But that was a key point of resistance, and you know, a lot of these politicians going back to their home districts and getting massive flack is part of that political resurgence. So. Yeah, it's interesting that the healthcare is sort of this sort of underlying key thing that's galvanizing both sides.
Yep, and it basically stopped the Clinton administration in its tracks in '93. You know, who knows what that presidency would have been without. Without that defeat, might not have been any better, but you know, it certainly did change the trajectory of the Clinton administration, and did the same thing for the Obama administration. I guess we can hope that you know, the attempt to repeal Obamacare now will do the same thing to the Republican agenda. It certainly seems like they're investing a lot of capital in it, but you know, that it's just amazing the way that healthcare has basically dominated American politics for so long, and that we can't seem to get it right. It's remarkable, but there doesn't seem to be any end in sight on that issue.
Well, listen, I should let you go. I know you only have a couple minutes before your meeting here. Thank you so much, Theo Anderson. Appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Okay, and we got another caller. Unfortunately, can't talk to Theo, but go ahead, Rod. You're on the air.
Yes, you know, talk about Christianity or evangelicalism. I think we're losing sight of the fact that there are many versions of Christianity, whether it's in the East or the West, and they all have the same thing in common. Basically, they tend to be self-serving, self-seeking, in terms of their own self-interest. So we need to start there, because there is no one Christianity anywhere. There never has been. I wonder if that should be remembered when we have these kind of discussions. Secondly, the global spiritual community, which takes in all the different faiths and spiritual paths, have the same problem. They develop themselves around their own self-seeking, self-interest, and then actually become part of the big global problem that we all are concerned about. So we need to talk about these things, and not so much in just the complexity of the little details, but what's the larger picture here, and what in particular is the role of the global spiritual community?
Well, you bring that up with a minute left.
Well, next time.
Okay. Next time, get in a little earlier. But yes, that's a huge question. I would have a lot to say about that, and I'm sure other people would too. But man, we got to get out of here. And sorry, Jack, we can't get to you and any other callers who might have. But thanks, Rod, for calling in, and thank you all for listening. and come back next week. And thank you all so much for being here as part of our community radio community here at 90.7 FM in Portland and the other frequencies in the Gorge and down in the down the valley. So thank you so much. This has been Paul Roland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned for more programming here on KBOO Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Dark Circle, is showing Thursday, March 16th at 7 p.m. Dark Circle is a documentary film that focuses on the connections between the nuclear weapons and the nuclear power industries. Again, that's Dark Circle, Thursday, March 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of A Night with Steve Early, Monday, March 20th at the Portland State University Bookstore in Portland. Steve Early, author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, will speak and discuss his book, which chronicles the 15 years of successful community organizing to create the progressive transformation of Richmond, California. Again, that's A Night with Steve Early, Monday, March 20th at the Portland State University Bookstore at 1715.